Judiciary Committee will come to order. Members, please take your seats. Chair recognizes a quorum. Members, we've got two bills on the agenda today. The first is a holdover from Monday. House File 998 will be going over. We've been going over our omnibus House File 631. 998. That's not right. This is not a bill relating to data privacy. This is Veterans Restorative Justice Act. So the plan was that we were going to refer it back to your committee. Is that right? Or does this need to go to Ways and Means, Chair Eklund?
Mr. Chair, members, I think it has to go to Ways and Means and then be referred back to my committee if that's
okay.
the direction that the chair
okay,
takes.
Okay, so the motion will be to refer it to Ways and Means. Can I have a motion? Representative Zhang moves that House File 998 be referred to Ways and Means. An amendment has been posted. There's an author's amendment. Let's deal with that first. What's the author's amendment, Representative Eklund?
The author's amendment was the one that Representative Moeller had some concerns about, and I believe we got that straightened out, and it should be in the packet.
Okay. Is that the A1?
I believe so, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So, Representative Moeller, did you want to explain that? Because I can't remember, honestly, what you said at the end of the last committee.
We changed the letter from A to B or B to A, Mr. Chair, and took the word duration out, I believe.
Okay. Okay.
And I didn't grab that, so I'm just going from memory.
That's the other amendment. It's going to be offered by Representative Moeller, right?
Yes.
I mean, I'm not.
No, I didn't think I had it in my packet. I just found it.
So are you good to offer it?
I am, Mr. Chair. I would offer the A1 amendment.
Okay. Good. Then Representative Moeller offers the A1 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. There is another amendment. Is this yours, Representative? I don't think we...
Mr. Chair, I can offer the A2.
Representative Lucero, I don't think I have the A2 amendment. Oh, wait. Oh, I do. Okay, do you want to go ahead and explain your A2 amendment, Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the Veterans Restorative Act is based upon the model of veterans treatment courts. However, funding for implementation of the Veterans Restorative Justice Act is not through the courts. If this committee is asked to provide funding to train courts, justice partners, and stakeholders to implement the Veterans Restorative Justice Act, it's important that the funding is provided with tight controls and financial accountability. So the A2 does two things. First, it makes the Department of Veteran Affairs the fiscal agent for the appropriation and establishes a competitive grant. And second, the amendment requires the grant recipient or recipients to report to the Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs and the legislature, which must include an overview of how the grant was used, the number of veterans and military served, and a list of the services provided to stakeholders. The public expects an accounting of how their tax dollars are spent, and that's why I would ask for support for this A2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there a discussion? Ripson O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the financials looks like they were put on the website, and I appreciate that, but maybe the author could speak to what actually was accomplished with the money that was provided, because I'm having a hard time seeing how it really did help the veterans. I was reading through the narrative and looking at the numbers, and maybe I just need a better explanation as it relates to this amendment as I understand it. Maybe the author of the bill could explain a little bit about the financials since this relates to that.
Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, the grant authorization was what helped set up this program and put it to get this bill into the what you have in front of the committee right now. The granting of the fiscal authority was through the humanities, and they put together this program with several county attorneys associations and other groups that have had veterans courts in the past, because we want to tighten up what was going on with the veterans courts. everybody was doing things just a little bit differently, so we wanted to come up with a more program that worked more uniformly throughout the state.
Ripson O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if someone else wants to come down and just...
Is there anyone else who could... It's kind of a question related to the details of the organization. Mr. Hunter here. Maybe Hunter, Mr. Hunter can answer the question. If you could rephrase... excuse me. If you could rephrase your question. Not rephrase, just restate your question. Ripson O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if you have that document in front of you, Mr. Hunter, but maybe you could just walk us through the financials, what you used the money for on your financials, and how that directly affected veterans and expanding veterans' courts, if that's what I'm understanding the money was for.
Mr. Hunter?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, certainly. I would refer the committee to the other report that we provided on Monday evening. This was the 20-page or so packet that we had previously filed with the House and Senate Veterans Affairs Committees earlier in the session. It goes into much more detail into exactly how we have used these grant funds over the past 2 years to move the ball forward for Minnesota's justice-involved veterans. In short, there were four fronts that we adopted to tackling this mission. The first of them was creating a working group, including judges from the various veterans courts in Minnesota, key county attorneys, and other stakeholders. We met monthly at the Judicial Center over the past 18 months, doing a deep dive into the practices of Minnesota's veterans courts, what was working, what was not working, and what could be done better. Out of that working group came the legislation before you, the Veterans Restorative Justice Act, which we believe will have a dramatic impact on justice-involved veterans in Minnesota in getting the existing veterans courts in Minnesota all on the same page, all using the same best practices so that veterans are receiving the same types of incentives and sanctions and benefits through the existing courts, but also setting up a structure for all the other jurisdictions in Minnesota, the vast majority of jurisdictions in Minnesota that don't have a veterans court and won't have a veterans court anytime in the near future, to immediately start using best practices to start helping the veterans in front of them and getting them moving forward. So that is the first front, and probably the most significant impact of the work that we've been doing is gaining consensus from all of these stakeholders, most significantly the County Attorneys Association, who's on board with this bill, to start adopting these practices statewide. The second front was a statewide legal education outreach effort. We conducted 20 legal education seminars over the past 18 months statewide, reaching approximately 1,000 criminal justice stakeholders, including judges, prosecutors, private and public defenders, probation officers, and law enforcement officers. The third front is research and writing. We've published two law review articles in the Mitchell-Hamlin Law Review in the past 18 months that address all of these issues in the veterans courts and how they could be improved. We also produced a 90-page policy white paper on these issues, as well as a number shorter, more digestible writings that were meant for the general public. The third front has been public education and outreach. It's important for the public to understand the types of issues that Minnesota brings Minnesota veterans into the judicial system. Both the public and I believe a lot of veterans themselves attach a great deal of stigma to justice involvement that relates to PTSD and their military service. And we have, in a variety of forms, done public outreach and education, first through an interactive website and then a Facebook page, and then engaging with a videographer to create a series of videos interviewing various justice stakeholders across Minnesota that work with veterans, as well as a number of veterans court graduates themselves, interviewing them and in a compelling way telling this story so that the public and other veterans can understand these issues and hopefully destigmatize them. Our Facebook page alone, our statistics show that we've reached approximately 42,000 people with our message over the last 18 months, And the videos that we have produced have been viewed approximately 9,000 times since we first started to introduce them and through social media in July of 2018. We have additional videos in the works right now. We are working with the Hennepin County Veterans Court to produce a video that will be used to show to veterans who are potential candidates for the Veterans Court program so that they understand what this is about, to hopefully educate them and incentivize them to participate in the court. And we would anticipate that once that video is completed, we would share that with all of the other veterans courts across the state so that they have that same tool to help recruit what are sometimes reluctant veterans to come into their program. I'm open to any additional questions you may have.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm actually looking at the financial statement that was provided. And out of the $250,000 for the grant, it looks like about $140,000 was for payroll. I don't know if it's two people, three people. I'm not quite sure. It's not broken up that way. And then you did mention some printing, so $25,000 just in some of the printing. I do have a question about, so this paid for office space too, so salaries and office space, and I thought the goal was to kind of help expansion of veterans courts and things like that. I'm hearing a lot of different things. Maybe you could just explain a little bit more about the, you know, some of the nuts and bolts here, the office space, the computer, the insurance, phones, you know, so basically setting up an entire office, it looks like, and then $25,000 in printing. And
certainly.
Mr. Hunter.
Mr. Speaker, Representative O'Neill, it's true the bulk of the grant has gone to payroll for our staff, myself, Ryan Els, and the executive director that we hired once we got the state grant money to help us formalize our program. The Veterans Defense Project has existed for a few years now, primarily on paper. It was an organization that we created during the course of publishing a book on defending veterans in criminal court. We were an unfunded nonprofit. We had a little bit of income coming in from sales of the book, but all of our work was pro bono. Up until we received the state grant, both work here in Minnesota doing this work as well as pro bono work on a nationwide basis. What this grant allowed us to do is formalize our operations and really focus on coming back home to Minnesota and doing what we could to help Minnesota veterans. We hired approximately 3 months into the grant period our executive director, and we needed a space for him. We rented an office space. And the printing, I should add, that printing budget was not actually used in the end for printing. We ended up deciding instead to put that money towards the production of these videos and other public outreach efforts that we in the end determined was a more effective use of those funds. And I think in the end, it turned out to be just so. They have had a major impact. As I said, approximately 9,000 people have viewed them. 42,000 people have been reached through our social media. So that was our initial budget for that first year. Our second year's budget is still not been reported yet because we are midway through, but we are happy to bribe the legislature with those numbers as well. I would also add that we were asked to come and testify before the House and Senate Veterans Affairs Committee last year, midway through the grant period. We filed a detailed report with each of those committees and provided testimony about the progress that we were making on our Minnesota mission.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how many veterans were you able to encourage to get into Veterans Court?
Mr. Hunter.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, it's hard to put numbers on it because the courts are not counting the number of veterans coming into the justice system at this point in time. What we can tell you is that in Hennepin County, we were able to verify through jail records that the number of veterans during the grant period has escalated dramatically that have been coming through the jail. At the same time, we found that initially the number of veterans in the Hennepin County Court had been declining. That is the clearest numerical evidence we have of trends that anecdotally we believe have been happening all across the state. But without being able to put a number on it, I can say that we've had a substantial impact, and I think the letters coming in from the courts as well as the county attorneys that we included in our packet submitted on Monday evening attest to their observations of the impact that we have been making. And this bill before you, I have no doubt will have an immediate impact because, again, it brings all of the existing courts in the state onto the same page, existing veterans courts using best practices, but empowering individual judges in jurisdictions that don't have a veterans court and may not have a veterans court for some time to immediately start implementing these best practices and doing better by the veterans coming before them, and paving the way for hopefully the establishment of veterans protocols and eventually veterans courts in those jurisdictions over the next few years.
Mr. Hunter, I'm looking at the report that your executive director filed in July of 2018 related to this question, that noted that the number of veterans referred to veterans courts, veteran treatment court, had plummeted. In fact, it was down by half in Ramsey County. And that was accounted for based upon the pulling out of the public defenders, I think was the explanation that was given, that if public defenders are not in the veterans courts, then there is less usage of the veterans courts. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right. What we found when we started our working group and started talking to the various stakeholders around the state was that there was declining buy-in by key stakeholder groups, particularly the public defenders, who saw this disparate treatment of veterans in the various veterans courts and were growingly concerned that they weren't really doing what veterans courts were intended to do. So the state public defender pulled all of the public defenders out of the state's veterans courts in 2017. And with that, support started to plummet, and the numbers coming into these courts started to decline because the defense attorneys that would typically be referring them were not referring them. One of the biggest benefits of this bill before you is that it is a result of a collaboration with the state public defender, Bill Ward, as well as the county attorneys, to come to a consensus about these best practices. And with the passage of this legislation, Bill Ward will and has pledged publicly in his testimony in committees this session on this bill, that with the passage of this bill, he will bring his public defenders back into the courts, and they will be fully engaged with veterans in existing veterans courts and as well as other jurisdictions across the state.
Thank you, Mr. Senator. Of course, this committee could just tell the public defenders that they need to go into veterans courts as well, I suppose. But go ahead, Rep. Sim O'Neill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I actually serve on the advisory board for Wright County for their drug court. And so I'm really trying to understand your role in getting veterans into veterans court, which I think is a good idea. But I'm just having a really hard time connecting the dots because there's so many different so the judge has an opportunity to recommend like the chair said, there's other players here that have a have an opportunity to recommend. I just, short of you saying, yes, we took from social media, we know, or whatever you're doing, getting the word out, but we took X, Y, and Z person and handed them to the Veterans Court. I don't see how you can substantiate the dollars. I don't have the number from me. Is it a half a million or something total and asking for 800 more? I'm not sure, but I just am having really, I'm really struggling to try to connect these dots. And like I said, I serve on the advisory board for Wright County's drug court, and I know how those folks get into drug court, and there's not a lack of participants that, you know, to come into drug court. So I guess I just am not seeing money well spent, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. I'm just really grappling with this. I really want to understand this. I really want to see this as something that could be helpful and successful, but I just am not there. I don't know, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rep. O'Neill. The amendment that we're on, excuse me, Rep. Lucero, is calling for this, I think, to be an RFP, is that right? The commissioner shall solicit bids. Is that accurate?
Correct.
Okay. And can you tell me, Mr. Hunter, have you ever considered going that route, presenting that way for an RFP and competing for who's going to do this best?
Well, Mr. Chair, we were never presented with any opportunity to submit an RFP, but we would certainly welcome that opportunity. without blowing our own horn too hard, I can represent that the Veterans Defense Project is a unique organization in the country. There really is no other organization advocating for justice-involved vets nationwide, but certainly not in Minnesota. We would welcome the opportunity to submit a bid against any other organization that might step up to the plate to do this kind of work. We have nothing to hide, and we're proud of the work that we've done. We believe the bill before this committee is cutting edge, again, not just here in Minnesota, but nationwide. This would take the best of other statutes that recently passed in other states and improve upon it, and would become a national model. I would add that the U.S. Justice Action Network, one of the largest and bipartisan criminal justice reform groups in the country, has taken a specific interest in this bill and has made it one of their Minnesota priorities this session. Their hope is that this bill will pass this session and will serve as a model for similar legislation nationwide.
Well, thank you, Mr. Hunter. I wonder, as we were talking about this and as you're describing what the Veterans Defense Project has done to try to bring education and awareness to the issue of veterans, I was thinking about another bill that I got up, which we need to make sure meets deadline, by the way, Commission on Data, the Legislative Data Practices Commission, which I think we can meet for a third deadline, but whatever. And that was an effort by Mary Liz Holberg to bring awareness and work on an ongoing working group to make sure that we correctly address all the data practices issues. And I don't know what the appropriation is for that, but I think we got a halftime FTE or something. Like, can Mr. Walls, can you speak to what it costs for us to put together the Data Practices Commission?
Mr. Chair, from memory, which is not perfect, I believe it was $136,000 the first year and $134,000 the second year and $135,000 ongoing after that.
Okay. All right, so that's for the commission, and that pays all the per diems for the legislators to get together and everything. And I think maybe the questions you're asking is just, are we getting our bang for our buck? Is that right, Representative O'Neill? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes.
Sure.
Go ahead, Representative Lucero.
I'm looking at a letter here that was passed out from the Office of the Washington County Attorney by Peter Orput. I just wanted to draw to members' attention here that this letter in support of the Veterans Defense Project of Minnesota, which we're discussing, he sits on the board, and you can see that listed in the Board of Directors on page 2 of this report. So just drawing that to the attention.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Johnson?
I'll wait till after this amendment.
Okay. Any other questions or discussion? Representative Councilman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I haven't heard whether the author is in support or opposition to the amendment.
Oh, well, I guess that's a good question, Chair Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I wasn't aware that this amendment was here when we came in. The Chair and I have had conversations about this. There is a separate funding bill going through on this same project. And I let the Chair election know last night that I would be interested in looking at this option on that funding bill when it's heard. This bill itself isn't asking for any money. This is just a policy bill.
Right. That's fair. And Representative Eklund, you and I did talk, and, I think, generally the impetus of what we're trying to do with diversions in this, I think, is probably a good direction. We have promises from the public defender that they'll reengage on that, which, according to the literature from the Veterans Defense Project, would probably be the single biggest factor in getting veterans back is just getting the public defenders back in there. And part of me just feels like, why don't we just tell the public defenders to go back into veterans court for free? But that said, it may well be that this is better brought up, Representative Lucero, when the funding piece does come back to us. Because we do fund the judiciary, and whether or not we tell the public defenders they got to be in or not. So I'm wondering if you would consider withdrawing this and then talking with Chair Eklund between now and when the funding piece comes back to us, so we might have a little bit better idea what we're talking about. Is that fair, Representative?
Mr. Chair, I think that's a fair point, so I'll withdraw the amendment.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to let you know that I did talk to Mr. Ben Johnson from MDVA, and if they were the fiscal agent, that wouldn't be a problem with them.
So. Okay, and I'm the amendment posted this morning, so we pretty routinely waive deadlines during deadline week, Chair Eklund, and I didn't actually see it until this morning, so I apologize for not.
I get that, Mr. Chair.
I you guys are all making me sick around here, too, because I don't know which way is up this morning. I'm fighting something. So, okay, so thank you. So Representative Lucero withdraws the A2 amendment, and we have the bill as amended with the author's amendment back on the table, and it's going to Ways and Means. The motion, who made the motion?
I don't.
Representative Mueller made the motion. I'm trying to steal his thunder there.
Chair Lesh.
Oh, who said that? Oh, Chair Johnson, go ahead.
I just had a couple questions. I know this is a program is a 501c3, and that I think the state is getting too much in funding all these 501c3s. I'm just wondering if this organization's ever tried any outside funding. They have an opportunity to do that, and I'm just wondering if they've done, even attempted any of that.
Thank you. Mr. Hunter?
Chair and Representative Johnson, we have, and in fact, we have recently received some additional outside funding, but this is an issue that, as we found, particularly challenged to arrange funding in the private sector. Veterans committing crimes is kind of a controversial issue, and a lot of the typical organizations that contribute funding to various veterans-related nonprofits have shied away from getting heavily involved in supporting an organization that's advocating on behalf of veterans who are committing crimes. And that was one of the impetuses behind us coming 2 years ago to the legislature to see if we could get some assistance so that we could devote some substantial time and energy to trying to fix what was increasingly becoming a broken veterans court system here in Minnesota. I would add, though, that given the accomplishments that we have made over the last 18 months on this grant period, we have started to see some additional interest from outside groups, including the U.S. Justice Action Network, the bipartisan group out of Washington, D.C., that has now added this this bill to their Minnesota priorities. They did provide us with a modest appropriation to help support our efforts this session and have indicated an interest in providing this additional resources going forward for work on this issue on a national level.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, I've been involved in the Judiciary Committee since I've been down here for 7 years. This is the first time I've heard that the veterans courts haven't been functioning properly.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. You know, that this could excuse me, ongoing conversation between now and when the funding bill comes back. That was why I did ask that one question the other day, just because of the fights that we have had in this committee and when it was public safety over the whole earmark versus send it through. It was always OJP that was really loud about why are you earmarking and why are you not sending these through OJP with oversight. And then once in a while, someone would squeeze through an earmark for something, but then it would fade away after a while. And I remember the fights that folks had, you know, like 12 years ago on that. They were, I don't know, they were kind of big fights. And I haven't heard a lot about them since then, but this just reminded me of that. Mr. Hunter, is the office space, is that just Veterans Defense Project office space? You only use that for Veterans Defense Project?
That office is an additional office in the building in which our law firm practices. We got that additional space when we hired our executive director. It is space that is devoted to Veterans Defense Project related issues.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for members of the committee? Oh, Chair Consonant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not a question. The support and care of our veterans is a basic government responsibility. And God bless the people and charities that step up when we fall short. But this is something that we should be funding and taking care of our veterans. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions before the committee, then the motion is from Representative Zhang that House File 998 as amended be referred to Ways and Means. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. You're on your way. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So now we're on. So, policy omnibus bill, which I don't know how ongoing this is going to be, but, you know, we'll see what happens. First thing is I'm going to be presenting the policy omnibus bill from the chair, and here it is. So the chair moves that House File 631. Did we already do the minutes, by the way?
No, not yet.
Huh? Well, let's just do it now because we'll forget.
May I move the minutes, Mr. Chair?
Yes. Chair Considine moves the minutes of March 13th. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. The minutes of March 13th are approved. Next order of business, the chair moves that House File 631 be recommended to be re-referred to be placed on the general register. Okay. Okay. And if we could, at the beginning, just have... Okay. Oh, right. Yeah, because it's got... Okay. So, yeah, this is the DE3. This is the omnibus bill. To put that in shape. So all in favor of the DE3, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. We have the bill before us as amended, and then we're going to have research walkthrough, right? Okay. Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, so we're going to walk through the DE3 amendment, House File 631. There are two articles. The first article is government data practices provisions. The second article is just civil law provisions. I will walk through Article 1. First, I want to say that none of the language that's incorporated in this article from the bills that this committee has previously heard changed since the committee heard the bills. So there were no changes other than what the committee did with its amendments when they heard the underlying bills. So Section 1 of Article 1, this is from House File 54. This removes the intent requirements from the data breach notification statute. This is on pages 1 to 2 of the amendment. Section 2 of the amendment, this is from House File 361. This is also Section 3, 5, and 18 of the bill. Sections 2 and 3 are the substantive parts of this bit. Sections 5 and 18 are mainly technical. So you'll want to look at pages 2 to 3 of the DE3 amendment. This is the transit data, rideshare data provision from House File 361. This makes permanent a temporary classification that the Department of Administration has given to expand a private or non-public classification for certain rideshare data so that it can apply to similar programs administered by any kind of government entity. Section 4 of the bill, this is on pages 3 to 4. This comes from House File 1567. This is regarding ignition interlock. It amends the definition of location tracking capabilities in the ignition interlock program statute to specify that the term includes direct or indirect location tracking via GPS or cell site location information. Turning to page 4 of the DE3 amendment, Sections 6 through 11, this is from House File 631. So this is the bill regarding tracking warrants. It clarifies distinctions between the different types of surveillance warrants that a court can issue under Chapter 626A. The bill is primarily concerned with warrants for location tracking information of electronic devices, but those can be confused sometimes with warrants for interception of a wire, electronic, or oral communication, wiretap warrants, or warrants for a pen register, trap and trace device, or mobile tracking device. So Sections 6 through 11 make some clarifications to help distinguish between those different types of warrants for various surveillance-type information. Turning to pages 10 of the DE3 amendment, Sections 12 through 17, these are all from House File 1197. House File 1197 would create the Minnesota Electronic Communications Privacy Act. That would prohibit government entities, including law enforcement agencies, from accessing information about electronic communications, so phone calls, emails, text messages, without a court warrant. The bill also imposes new requirements on warrants for electronic communication information, mandates that government entities notify individuals whose information is the subject of a search warrant, provides remedies for individuals affected by violations of the bill's requirement, and requires the judiciary to report to the legislature on warrants issued. Finally, in Article 1, Section 18, that is just a repealer from the transit data bill that repeals a duplicative data classification for rideshare data. So that section is part of the transit data piece from House File 361. It's purely technical. So that concludes Article 1.
Thank you.
Chair.
Ms. Mullen, are you taking Article 2?
Yes.
Excellent.
Chair and members, I'm going to walk you through Article 2, which was the general civil law provisions. These start on page 18. The first section of Article 2 is House File 1196. It's related to the protection of employee passwords for social media and networking sites. It prohibits an employer from requiring or forcing an employee or applicant to tell the employer about their username or password for social media accounts, or from showing them their social media accounts when they're private. And it prevents them from taking negative action against an employee if they refuse to share that information or from refusing to hire them. It also provides some exceptions, and it allows an employee to sue for damages if there are damages due to the violation. On page 21, sections 2 through 6, this is House File 561. This is these sections relate to non-paternity actions, and it provides standards for the court to adjudicate non-paternity actions. It also harmonizes the time a father has to assert non-paternity. On page 26, section 7, this is House File 1521, and it's section 7 and 8. They require the court in every jurisdiction in the state to include information about parenting education programs on the court's website. It also provides that when parents haven't agreed to custody or parenting time, they have to attend a program in person or online, and that the court has to notify parties they have the option to resolve their disputes through mediation. Section 9 is House File 1666. It requires the court to use a rebuttable presumption that the child shall have the maximum amount of time with each parent and get as close to 50% of the parenting time as they can to each parent, unless they have a reason to deviate from that. It provides a list of additional considerations for the court to consider. These are new factors when determining parenting time. And also prohibits the use of parents' marital status or the child's age as factors. Section 10 is is Representative Lean's guardianship bill. This is on page 30. It amends the requirements for background studies for parents who are guardians of their children, and it provides an exception for ongoing background studies when the child was in their parents' care but placed in a residential facility before the age of 18.
So I got one question. Mr. Evans, is Mr. Evans here? Did you work that stuff out that we talked about yesterday? Do you guys think you got like a little accord or anything? I want to do the easy stuff first if we can. Huh? Okay. Okay, that's fine. Okay, let's just bring down testifiers now. Irene Cowell. Oh, you're not going to testify? Okay, we're waving. Ben Feist. Never deny an opportunity to get to a microphone, Mr. Feist. Go ahead. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Feist.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ben Feist, Legislative Director with the ACLU of Minnesota. I just want to give a little bit of an update on the provision around the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. As this committee heard, law enforcement continues to have some concerns with the framework that was presented here. And so we have been trying to set up meetings, which has been actually a little bit difficult given how much work this body has been producing for all of us. But we did finally get to sit down as a group of stakeholders yesterday and begin to really flesh out the issues so that we can address this. We did not have time to put together amended language, but I think we are moving in that direction. So I really do support the idea of keeping this language in the bill for the time being, and with an understanding that it will be greatly narrowed in scope by the time it moves forward past this.
Okay, well, I can tell you I really do appreciate your work on that, working with people. I appreciate it, Mr. Evans, your commitment to that, and you know, we'll move forward. So thank you. Any questions for Mr. Feist? None. Then Mr. Evans, you want to speak to this? Go ahead. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Falling apart here. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Drew Evans. I am the superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. As Mr. Feist at the ACLU noted, we've had an opportunity to speak about a number of provisions in this bill that raise concerns for us. We've had good discussions. We're moving forward with a number of understanding of narrowing that scope and really trying to address the concerns of the ACLU on this bill and getting to a place where we can. As we've testified previously, there are a number of concerns in particular the electronic communications portion of the bill that would severely hamper our ability to conduct our work at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and law enforcement in general. Those provisions, I think, we can get closer to getting to the point of getting to those concerns of making sure that law enforcement is not accessing content and location information without the proper legal service. And so we've been working on that with him to work on that from there. There is one provision I do want to highlight for the committee that I think is probably an unintended consequence of a change to our the cell tracking provision or the cell tracking piece in here. And that is, in particular, that the definition for a mobile tracking device that was expanded in that location, it now would implicate, we agree that we need a tracking warrant to get that. The new definition as amended or in this, it would implicate our ability to use our Cellbrite devices. And what those are that I want to highlight for all of you is it's a data extraction tool that we use in our digital multimedia evidence laboratory. We already are required to get a warrant or valid consent to do that work. This would now place that under the tracking warrant provisions, which is different and a change as opposed to, and I don't think that was the intention, but the way that that provision is worded would require us now in the mobile tracking amended discussion to do that. And so we continue to have concerns with that. We agree with the purpose of clarifying 6268.42 to clarify the original intent that those orders will be public information that when they're filed and that notice will occur under that provision. Beyond that, for the other provisions in here, again, we're working closely with the ACLU. I think we're making a lot of progress with that, and I'd be happy to address our specific concerns, or if you'd like us to continue working with the ACLU, Mr. Chair, I think we can come to a good place.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Seeing law enforcement work with the ACLU just gives my heart this warm fuzzy, and we're very proud of it, so thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, Cassandra Hearn. And the next testifier will be Molly Olson. Thank you. Welcome back to the committee, Ms. O'Hearn, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cassandra O'Hearn, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. This chair is really tall. Just let
it gives a little lever on the right.
Yeah, but then I'll like fall, yeah, right? And wow. Okay. Anyway, my feet barely touch the ground. I'm here to talk about the portions of the bill that expand the definition of location tracking capabilities for the Ignition Interlock Program. And currently, any location, geographic location device must be obtained by court order. The expansion in this bill adds cell site location information. What that does is that means that an ignition interlock device cannot use cell technology in order to operate. In order to transmit any other type of information, such as recording of the breath sample, if there's been a violation or anything like that. So there's really two separate issues that this particular definition impacts. It impacts both the ability to obtain information, location data without a court order, and the department does not is comfortable with language that requires a court order for any location device that could be created by using an ignition interlock. That's not a concern. What is a concern, however, what the department does not support is subsequent limitations that by not being able to utilize cell phone information, that means that they cannot provide real-time reporting capabilities. What does that mean? Why is real-time important? Studies have shown whether it is in child raising or in with respect to offenders of any sort, right, that if there's a consequence, there needs to be that consequence should be provided as close in time to the action. And real-time reporting allows that to happen. That means that if somebody has a violation, that gets reported and action can be taken, whatever is the appropriate action for that particular individual, whether it's suspending a license, canceling a license, whatever the appropriate action is. Without that real-time capability, that action to the license cannot occur until that individual goes in to recalibrate their device, and that is can be up to 30 days or longer. So a person would have valid driving privileges for that entire period of time after they have had a failed sample provided. And I don't know if that was the intent, but that is what happens here as a result. So this is a best practice. There have been real-time devices used in Minnesota as long as 2011. At this current time, every interlock provider has provided a real-time device for certification. All of the providers but one have had real-time devices in operations since 2016, and the one company has provided a real-time reporting device that's undergoing certification right now. So this would be a substantial step backwards in technology with respect to the ignition interlock. It would impact about 8,500 participants currently, would require the removal of existing devices that work and have worked, and there has been no allegations that their location tracking has been somehow obtained. Again, if somebody wants to obtain that information from triangulation from a cell phone with a court order, that makes the department doesn't have a problem with that. The department does not obtain any of the location tracking devices and are comfortable with the limitations that are in existing law that prohibit us from doing that. Do I stand for any questions, if there are any?
Questions for Mr. Hearn. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I recall this conversation that we had when you were up testifying before, but what I don't recall is that you actually use real-time data. It seemed to me that we had a long conversation about the process of what happens, and I know we have someone here from Ignition Interlock as well, or one of the companies that provide it, and what you were just describing as a hindrance, you don't actually do, isn't that correct? You don't actually do real-time reporting. If there's a violation, then the car doesn't start, they have to go and get a code, or they have to go and get it recalibrated. So I'm failing to understand why this is a problem.
Ms. O'Hearn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, and thanks for the question, because that did come up in the last hearing, and I think there is a understanding how the machine works, right? So if I have an ignition interlock device in my vehicle, and I go to the bar and I get drunk and I get into my car and I blow into that, if it will not start. Then there's a period of time, I think it's 15 minutes, that you have an opportunity to provide a clean sample, right? So you can do that, blow again. If it's not a clean sample, I think there's a period of time to do it, and the car will not start. However, if you go home and I come back to the to bar to get my car a day later, I can get into that vehicle, blow a clean sample, and start the car. That failed samples and that period of time that the car did not start, that's the violation we're talking about. And that would not be reported to the department to take action on their license, if that's the appropriate action, or extend the time period for them to be in the program, whatever is the appropriate action for the type of violation, would not get reported until they go in for that monthly calibration. So it is different. You do have the ignition interlock device immediately stopping, I can't start my car. But there is no action on your license, or your ability to drive, or even knowledge at that point to the department that that violation had occurred until they go in, and that could be up to 30 days later.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I also recall in that conversation, and that was different than the testimony that was given earlier, but nonetheless, I also recall that in the ignition interlock program that your department doesn't actually take any action until later now. Is that not correct? When do you actually take action? Do you take action immediately when you find a violation, or does it take a month or 2 months or at the end of the program? When do you actually take action on someone's license or something else?
Ms. O'Hearn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is that action is taken upon notification of the violation. So, again, depending, there are in law requirements, so it might be if suspension of your license is the appropriate thing. I believe there's a notification that goes out, so that notification would happen after that violation is recorded. That notification would go, because by law I believe that it's 7 days, and somebody can correct me if I'm wrong about that. But there is a notification period, and then that action is taken.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's not the testimony that we had in the previous hearing. I believe the testimony was that even at the end of the ignition interlock program is when sanctions would happen. And I'm just seeing very conflicting testimony from the previous committee to hear, and I just still fail to understand why this is a problem with the previous testimony. And I'm just more confused now than when I started my line of questioning, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rep. O'Neill. Other questions for Ms. O'Neill? Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Mr.
Testifier. So I go to the bar, I have a couple beers, I come out, I blow into the interlock, the car doesn't start, I catch an Uber and I go home, I come back the next day perfectly sober, I didn't drive, I didn't move. What exactly did I violate that you need instant reporting that minute, like at midnight or 10 o'clock at night? Well, I'm completely confused on why you need something that day and what exactly did I violate.
Ms. O'Hearn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. So, and I really hope there's somebody standing behind me if I say something incorrect. But the I can't necessarily answer for there are conditions and there are repeat offenders that have zero tolerance. So for an individual who's in that position, having alcohol at all at that point would be a violation. I do not know what the scope, because there are different violations for different levels of we can get more information about all of the various different provisions about that. that real-time reporting, to be honest, is going to be the next business day. So no action is going to happen at 10 o'clock at night or at midnight. But that would be reported the following business day, where if it is a violation that is actionable, that action would happen. If that was not a violation, it would not be. There's also time periods when individuals come in because there have been multiple violations. They meet with evaluators, and they have they want to describe what happened. It is easier, and this happens in practice now, when an individual can do that and say, this happened to me 2 days ago, rather than this happened to me 30 days ago, 45 days ago, whatever the time period is, because it is often difficult at that point to figure out really what is happening either with the device or what is the appropriate action to take given the specific situation.
Mr. Barr.
Mr. Chair, so you could do a data dump once a day at like 9 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock in the morning or something like that on everything. You wouldn't need real-time reporting then, would you?
So the real-time
Ms. O'Hearn.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. The real-time reporting is done to the manufacturer. The manufacturer does do that data sharing the next business day. But that information that is what real time does, because otherwise it is held, in my terminology, in a black box. The information is in a black box. If you do not have real time reporting, if the device itself cannot communicate directly, I know there are manufacturers here and they can talk about their devices much better than I can, but the way that the device communicates with the manufacturer is through cell phone technology. Otherwise, it is held in a black box. And then once a month, that Interlock participant needs to go to have that black box, all the information in the box, dumped. And that is the monthly. And as far as, again, the workings of the machine and how they do that, I believe that there are others that can testify to that as they have been performing that for a number of years.
Mr. Chair. I just want to make one quick comment to that. So the use of technology through a cell phone tower, for example, is a completely separate event than collecting somebody's geographic location. So, for example, I could call Representative O'Neill right now from my cell phone, and it would use cell phone towers, but Representative O'Neill is not going to know my location through GPS technology. So there's a distinction there. So as I mentioned previously when this was before us, real-time reporting can be uploaded and yet still not collect a person's GPS location. So just an important point, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Lucero. Representative Barr.
I'm good.
Okay. So this real-time reporting, Ms. O'Hearn, does real-time reporting involve transmission of location information?
It does not, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So then Section 4, you shouldn't have a problem with, right?
The way that Section 4 is drafted, it is so broad that it appears to prohibit cell site, the ability to use cell phone transmission for the data, not for the location.
Okay. Well, Ms. O'Hearn, you know, this committee has for years had issues with breaching personal privacy items and then making sure we have open government. Those have been two watchwords that this committee has relied on, no matter who's chaired it over the years.
And I think if those were your major concerns when you moved in the direction of this GPS business, you would have worked with the committee. But instead, in my opinion, the Department of Public Safety abused its exemption from rulemaking to bulldoze this through. So you'll probably have to forgive some of the suspicion about protests now coming from the department, because there's a little bit of broken trust there. And when it was raised in the midst of that, there was huge pushback from the department at that time, too. And I still have a little bit of heartburn over that. So I see you down here. You're doing your job. I appreciate that. But folks on the committee remember that. So, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, I remember that conversation very well, and I remember the department actually coming and justifying the fact that they should have location tracking so that, God forbid, there's a child in the car when someone is intoxicated. They should be able to jump in and intervene. So we've come so far afield from that conversation. And then, you know, I just did a quick little sidebar with Mr. Cohen. Actually, it was Ward Ines that represents Mr. Cohen, and saying he might even want to come down and testify and just set the record straight, because much of the testimony we heard is not what really happens today. And I think it's important we understand what does the department actually do today. And we got a little bit closer with the conversation back and forth, but it's important for us to actually make decisions based on the reality of what's happening. And I think you got a lot closer by just asking that very pointed question, but if you'd like, Mr. Cohen could come down and actually set the record straight, since he's the manufacturer of the device, knows exactly how it works and all of that. But I just want to mostly point out the fact that when we had this conversation before, the department actually justified their stand in actually getting that location tracking information. And so that's why the pushback, and I appreciate you bringing that back up, too.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. O'Hearn? Thank you for your testimony, Ms. O'Hearn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, where's that list? I think I probably took it from you. Yeah. There was one more. Oh, it was Molly Olson. Molly Olson, are you going to come and test? There you are. I like the hat and the bling. Looks great. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am here just to ask once again your support for the equal shared parenting provision in the omnibus bill. I have been doing this for 20 years, trying to get this presumption of equality into Minnesota law. It's nothing new. It's nothing radical. It's nothing fringe. It is what the research says. Over 60 research studies say it is in the best interest of children to maximize parenting time after divorce and separation whenever possible, with certain exclusions. Over the last 20 years, 7 of those years I have spent in task force groups that have met at least monthly, sometimes 4 times a month, with the opponents to try to understand what are their objections and how can we come to some compromises on the language that will satisfy their greatest concerns. They have told me that 90% of their concerns are addressed in what they call the big three: mental health issues, substance abuse issues, and domestic violence. Those are all included as a very clear, very precise exceptions in this bill. The opposition has also stated throughout the years that they have other questions about not wanting it to be a mandate. Therefore, we have included in this bill the word rebuttable. And rebuttable by its nature means that it's not a mandate. Most lawyers, most judges, most legislators know that. The opposition also talks about not wanting to limit judicial discretion. As I testified at the committee for this bill, at the committee hearing, I mentioned that a Hennepin County judge had written a report in 2003 that said family law has the most discretion for judges of any other place in statute and law anywhere. This, and that judge referred to like 1,000 places of discretion in family law. This is not going to limit restrict their discretion. They are going to have discretion. The Minnesota Court of Appeals has pretty much legislated from the bench almost and said that the trial court judges have broad, pretty much unbridled discretion in family court. So that part's not going to go away. The sections in this bill about age are also a compromise for the opponents. The research says that equal shared parenting works for children of all ages, but the opponents have had 60 studies, 110 researchers have said that equal shared parenting should not be limited by age. But the opponents fear, they rely on one study that's actually been rebutted heavily by qualified, credible, peer-reviewed researchers. But nevertheless, we try to include some options in there for the young children to appease the opponents and to give them some sense of comfort with this. When the civil rights movement and the civil rights laws were addressed, they didn't say, let me say that there seems to me there's three options right now. We can continue with the 25% presumption, which is totally lopsided. People go into court figuring that one's going to be a 25% and one's going to be a 75% parent, and if you want 50, you have to fight for it. When you're a fit, loving, responsible parent that's ready, willing, and able to step up to the plate, and you've never even had a speeding ticket. So the options are A, to keep the 25%, B, to have a 50-50, an equal playing field. Or three, there is a very disturbing amendment that's going to be, added or requested later, which is to remove the 25% completely and have no presumption whatsoever in there. That sets us back. I've been doing this for 20 years, and I know that between 2000 and 2006, when we were fighting then for equal shared parenting, it was a compromise. The 25% in law was a compromise, baby step. So taking that away would be a complete reversal of the baby step that was done. So in conclusion, I just want to say that when the civil rights laws were introduced, the laws didn't say, there's no presumption for or against equality. The civil rights laws didn't say there's a presumption of 25%, you got to fight for the rest. When you passed the marriage equality bill, you didn't write there's no presumption for or against marriage equality, or in 25% of the cases we'll have marriage equality, but you got to fight for the rest of those situations. No, it's about equality. And this bill is about celebrating the diversity and the all of the things that both parents can offer these children. When children look in the mirror, they see half their mom and half their dad. They're two moms, just let's set that aside just for the moment. But whatever it is, they see both of their parents. And when one of them is missing, part of that child is missing. So please, I ask you to keep this section in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Ms. Olson, is there anyone else who wants to be heard? We're going to do amendments, so if you want to speak to the bill and up and down, I recommend that you wait until the amendments are over to see how the bill ends up. But we're going to be doing these amendments. The first one we'll take up is the A3 amendment. What? Do you want to speak not on the amendments?
Yes.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kristen Anderson. I am General Counsel for Minnesota Management and Budget. And I just want to speak briefly on Section 1 of the bill, which removes the intent requirement from the data breach notification statute. We do understand and appreciate
Ms. Anderson, yes. There's an amendment on that.
Oh.
So, maybe you want to save your comments until the amendment. Does that work?
It's up to you, Chair.
I think we should probably, because I'm sure we're going to be debating each one of these.
All right,
and then you'll come up again during that time, and I'm trying to
move it along. I understand, Mr. Chair.
We've been here late every night, so thank you. I appreciate it, Ms. Anderson. Okay, so the first one coming up is the A3. Representative Mahler moves. Oh, that's right, the easy one. Okay. A2 is the cops came to me and said, hey, don't apply the background check piece to cops because we got to make sure that we're screening cops. And the cops all agree.
everything. And I don't know. I think that's fine, right? I don't have it. Does anyone have an issue with this? Well, let's speak to the. I'll move the A2 amendment. Any discussion? Okay. All in favor of the A2 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. The A2 amendment is adopted. The A3 amendment. Representative Mahler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So I move the A3 amendment. Do I need to speak on the amendment now?
If you like.
All right. So the reason for this amendment is to do a couple of things. It puts the focus back on the best interest of the child statute, which is in a different provision than the one that the shared parenting bill intends to cover, and that's 518.17. And I just wanted to read for the members a couple of the factors right now that the court must consider. In evaluating the best interest of the child for purposes of determining issues of custody and parenting time, the court must consider and evaluate all relevant factors, including, and this is number 10, the benefit to the child in maximizing parenting time with both parents and the detriment to the child in limiting parenting time with either parent. And it's my understanding, based on the history of the different groups working on this issue, that that was the compromise language that was reached. There's another provision in that statute that says the court shall consider that it is in the best interest of the child to promote the child's healthy growth and development through safe, stable, nurturing relationships between a child and both parents. And another provision that the court shall consider both parents as having the capacity to develop and sustain nurturing relationships with their children unless there are substantial reasons to believe otherwise. It goes on to describe some other things. So nobody's disputing that both parents should be involved in a child's life, and the best interest factors already take that into consideration. Now, a couple of the issues that I had with the bill as it was presented really came about as a result of some of the testimony. I went into that hearing with a very open mind on this issue. And when I heard, especially from the domestic violence MCBW, that they had concerns with this, and here's where that concern is. If you look at the bill on line 29.5 on page 29, in order to rebut the presumption of 50-50, a person has to establish by clear and convincing evidence, and then down on line 29.14, domestic abuse. And as the testifier explained at the last hearing, the problem with that is if a person gets an order for protection, that is received by a preponderance of the evidence standard, which is a lower standard than the clear and convincing evidence. So someone could have an order for protection against their partner, and then that is still not enough to rebut this clear and convincing standard, and I feel like that will have a chilling effect on victims. I also had concerns with line 29.7 through 29.9 related to mental illness. And that provision says that a parent has a mental illness that was diagnosed by a licensed physician or licensed psychologist. The mental illness endangers the safety of the child based on the opinion of the licensed physician or licensed psychologist treating the parent. And the problem I have with that provision, that is not the intent of what it's getting at, but the fact that we're violating the patient-client privilege. We talk a lot about privacy in this committee. We talk a lot about privacy, and that is very concerning to me, that mental illness provision. Now, I understand we had passionate testimony on both sides, of this issue when we heard this in committee. And some of the things that I heard were that even though this 2575 that's in statute was meant to be a minimum standard, it sounded to me from the testifiers that courts were actually applying it as the basis, 2575. And so that was the intent of taking out that language here. Another thing that we heard was from a number of men who said they had been in unmarried relationships, and it seemed like the courts were assuming that because parties were not married, that somehow should be held against them, and that's wrong, and that's why we included language to that effect in the amendment that we're offering. So in this bill, or this amendment, by eliminating the 25% language, leaving everything in the best interest standard, which does encourage and says the court shall consider that it maximize time with both parents, I believe that this is the best way to address the issues raised.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mueller, one of the things we try to do around here is when we have a problem with somebody's bill, we come to them and try to work it out. And so I really wish that you would have done that. And I understand you're new and all that, and I'm appreciative of that. There's not any of those issues that you brought up that can't be worked out. And I just want to say that, you know, this is one of the reasons that I came to the legislature. I shared that in the committee hearing that evening. This is an issue I care deeply about. And I was part of that so-called compromise group. I think the bill has been on the books now. The new best interest standards have been on the books for 4 years now. And let me give you a little backup, a backstory about that, the commission that we were on. There was supposed to be follow-up on with the courts to educate them on these new best interest factors. And the subcommittee that was supposed to take that up never did a thing. So here we are, 4 going 5 years later, and things are not changing in the courts. Some of the people that you heard from the other night had freshly gone through the court system, and nothing has changed. And that's disappointing. And I know that I've seen the family law attorneys in that section of the bar, I've seen them lurking around the Capitol, so I know that they've talked to many of you. And so we have a decision to make here. First of all, I will oppose this amendment, and you may very well have the votes to pass it. We're missing a member today. But I will say this. Around this place, we listen an awful lot to lobbyists and paid people. And we don't do a lot of listening to the citizens of the state of Minnesota. And when they're hurting, we tend to ignore them. And this is an issue that speaks volumes about that. And we have a bunch of people that come down here, take time away from their jobs, because this is something that they, an injustice that they see that needs to be corrected. And I guess I would ask Ms. Olson, if it's okay with the chair, to come back up and have comments, or maybe you're planning to do that anyway, Mr. Chair, comments on this amendment. I'll leave it at that, and I may have comments later, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Chair Scott, Ms. Olson already spoke to in her initial testimony. I guess if there's questions, you can come up and ask those, but I just don't want her to just repeat herself on that. We'll see what kind of questions come up. Chair Mariani.
Mr. Chair, members, just very briefly, I know that this, evokes very strong emotions. I think probably a good number of legislators here have experienced one side or the other, court determinations that have impacted their family. That certainly has happened with my single-parent father as well, or son. My son was a single-parent father. But very quickly, I just for the record, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, I am tipping my hat to you in terms of the emotion. But frankly, the statement that this legislature does not listen to the citizens of the state of Minnesota is just false. I could tell you, in my committee, we bend over backwards to make sure that regular folks are part of both the conversations in our offices as well as in our committee room. Last night we had an incredible hearing with survivors of sexual assault, even children. And so just for the record, if we're going to put those kind of statements on the record, then I think it needs to be rebutted officially on the record. And I look forward to continuing then the debate, and let us get back focused on the merits of the amendment before us.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, yes, thank you, Representative Mariani. Well, we listen very closely to our friends, our neighbors, and our constituents. It's very clear in terms of how we inform, what informs our opinions. In addition, I wouldn't refer to groups such as Legal Aid and MCBW as paid lobbyists. So, and they have stated that they are in support of this new language. So, and I worked with Representative Mueller on this language, and you know, we both, in our experience in taking away from the testimony, and I've had the opportunity to hear this in past years as well, is really trying to keep the focus on that of those that are most impacted by this, which is the children. So putting aside those needs of the parents and focusing squarely on what is in the best interest of the child. And that's what's driving this amendment. That 20%, in my opinion, is getting in the way of making a decision based on those standards that were set 4 years ago. And if we want to talk about equality, then let's approach this based on the facts and the merits of the case. We took to heart the testimony from some of the men in terms of their treatment of being treated unfairly. And we thought by putting that into this amendment and making it very clear that, married or not, that that should not be held against them in the decision of how much parenting time they get. So I hope as the conversation continues, we can remain civil, that we truly are all after the best interest of the children in this case. And I look forward to hearing the comments of others. But please, if we can really work at crafting a piece of legislation here which truly does, which is a very highly charged emotional issue, and focus on what is truly in the best interest of the children and put aside our personal experiences and those of what we've heard from others and what really is in the best interest of Minnesota's children, I think we can reach an agreeable outcome. So I'll stop at that.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, members. I had to serve the papers. I had to go and take the kids away from their dads and bring them to their moms. Because that's what the order said. This amendment takes away that minimum of 25% for the father. And all the studies have shown that children are much better off with a mom and dad in their lives. Before we went to 25%, I don't know how many men had zero custody. They got visitation once every 2 weeks for a weekend. By moving it up to a minimum of 25%, they had more time with their kids. When you go back to zero, now the kids are put in the middle of the battle. It's not in the best interest of the kids. The children is the most important thing that we want. And by starting in the middle, everybody knows where it is. This bill is just going 100% backwards from where we were and hurting the kids.
Chair Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm speaking in support of the amendment, but I want to make a few comments, and then I'm going to see if perhaps Representative Mueller would incorporate a change to her amendment as we proceed here. I do want to, first of all, I was here when we had the grand compromise, if you would, and this was and has always been a very bitter, divisive issue. And I really do appreciate, as other members have said, that there are a lot of emotions on both sides, because there's very little that's as important to people as parenting their own children. And we can all appreciate that. The thing, though, is that we, as I recall, after the grand mediation, and I was not on the task force, but I was following along with it pretty closely. I appreciated all the time that was put in by the people who did, including Chair Scott. There was a compromise that, as I recall, passed off the floor of the House, I think unanimously. And that was the language that we have now, current statute, that attempted to put the needs of the child first, with due recognition that the best interests of the child, really, in the where both parents are reasonable, competent people, does involve having parenting time with both parents. So, you know, I appreciate all this emotion around this issue. And I do want to say, as I said back then, that I actually am a child of divorced parents, and my dad got custody. And this was many, many years ago. My mom had a mental illness, which, by the way, was never diagnosed. So this provision, had my parents been under the provisions of this bill, this would not have stopped my mom from getting custody, because she had an undiagnosed mental illness, and it was a damn good thing that my dad got custody, by the way. And he did the best job he could, and this was, of course, way back in the time when dads really didn't get custody. So, you know, I'm not opposed to dads having custody by any means. And by the way, my two grandchildren are my son's children. So I am not opposed to dads having custody. My son is, I think, a very good dad. And God forbid, if there was a divorce, I would certainly want him to have custody, part, you know, part custody or halftime or whatever, parenting time. But I just would say that if the courts didn't implement this, and, you know, that's certainly possible, I would say the remedy to that is to do something to make sure that that happens, not to change the law. So I think that the bill is, if the problem is that the courts are still showing implicit bias against dads, that is the problem that we should be trying to solve and trying to educate and retrain our judges to be more fully open to the benefit that fathering brings to children. So I think that is where I would want to go with that. I'm glad that Representative Mariani spoke briefly about this issue about lobbyists. I have to say I have not been lobbied on this at all. And two, there's a dynamic around here that the people who are unhappy with something are the people who are going to show up. I think there are probably many, many other cases where people have been in court under this law that's only been in place for a few years, and because things probably worked reasonably well for them, they're not mad and they're not showing up. So, you know, just because, you know, there are some citizens who are coming here to tell us about their bad experiences does not mean that it's all on that side. And that's just the dynamic of the way it works around here generally. I don't think this is about lobbying. I want to respond briefly to something Ms. Olson said, that this is about equality and so on. This law does not say moms and dads. It talks about parents. And so this is a really different thing. I grant you there may be still implicit bias against men in divorce court, in parenting. We cannot, but this bill cannot legislate that away. It is not good for children. We need to address implicit bias as implicit bias. We can't legislate it away, and we need to perhaps address that with our courts and making sure that they follow through with what the law says. So anyway, with that, I do recognize that even though Representative Mueller really intended to do something helpful here in taking out these lines and on the amendment 2.10 through 2.12, taking out the language of the 25% parenting time, she intended to, I believe, really fix things and make things more fair for dads. But I understand that that's not how it's viewed by Representative Scott or the folks on the other side. So I would ask her if she would incorporate an amendment to her amendment, if the chair would allow her to do that, to remove lines 2.10 to 2.12 of her amendment. In other words, keeping the 25% in the current law, in the bill. And then I didn't really hear anything from Representative Scott about the other part of the amendment, line 2.17, which about not using a parent's marital status, which I also support that part of the amendment. I think that's a good advance. I don't know if there's any objection to that piece, but I'll stop there and see if Representative Mueller would want to incorporate that into her amendment.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I would be willing to do that. And I don't know if the appropriate thing for me to do is to move to incorporate an amendment to the amendment. in that we would be removing the strike through from lines 2.10 to lines 2.12.
If Mr. Muller moves to strike, Ms. Mullen?
Chair and members, I'm just going to read that back to you. On page 2, lines 10 through 13 of the A3 amendment, the motion to incorporate into the amendment is to reinstate the stricken language.
I'd be like page 2, line 10 through line 12. Is that right, Ms. Mullen? That is the amendment. All in
favor? Chair, Mr. Chair?
Who, Representative Lucero.
Just a quick question. So we're present. So we've incorporated the DE already. So is this technically an amendment to an amendment? And then if that's the case, I'm not sure that you can do an amendment to an amendment to an amendment. So I just a question.
Well, those are, Representative Lucero, those are floor rules, and I don't have a rule prohibiting that in this committee. As far as I'm concerned, it's rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, so I'm going to let it proceed. Did I say that out loud? It's all in favor of the oral amendment to the A3 amendment as stated by Ms. Mullen, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed say no. No. Motion passes. Okay. Are you all done then, Representative Ligon?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, with that, I just would say that I would urge members to support the amendment.
Okay, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason I asked that question is I had great concerns with that language, and I wanted to make sure that that was removed because it is current law to have the 25%, and it would have been a travesty to move us backwards to zero rather than what the discussion has been to move us forwards up from 25%. So I am very pleased that at least that's been removed. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. I think the discussion about the reinstatement of this stricken language is one of the most illustrative in this debate, members. What we argued about right there is both sides coming at this completely different perspectives on how a judge in family court would treat this. Completely different. And let me tell you, I think I'm the only one in this at this table that has practiced any family law. And let me tell you that with the exception of calculation of child support and determination of custody matters, judges do what they want. They absolutely do what they want. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to address that. One of the things that came out of the child custody dialogue working group was that we added the word minimum of in front of 25% because judges were treating the 25% as a ceiling, not a floor. And that's been in there going on 5 years. Nothing's changed. And I also want to address the piece about a marital status not being a determinant. And while I'm for that not being a determinant, I'm not sure that putting it here is going to be congruent with some other areas of statute. There's a lot of hoops that unmarried fathers and unmarried parents have to jump through. And I'm not sure just this two-line sentence is going to make all that much difference. And I don't know how it works with the rest of statute. I don't know if Ms. Mullen can help or not, but, you know, they have to go through a recognition of parentage. They have to go. So would this scrap all of that by saying that the marital status is not a problem? So, in other words, if there are two single parents and we're trying to establish who the father is and that whole rigmarole, how would this play into that?
Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, I do not know how the court would interpret that. I believe that the author of the amendment stated what her intent is with it, but you might want to ask her to clarify that.
Chair Scott.
If Representative Mueller wants to clarify that.
Yes, Mr. Chair Scott, I had when I was trying to figure out where to put this, did ask if this was the best place or if it should be in the best interest of the child, if that should be a factor to be considered there. But is my intent that the court should not, you know, it says shall not consider parents' marital status, that that is controlling, and the court shouldn't take that in consideration. Now, if there's another place, we need to include it in other places in statute. I'm open to doing that later, but that is the intent with this provision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in my opinion, you'd have to put a complete repealer on the sections of law that talk about recognition of parentage, and there's a whole section of law that applies to never married parents. And so I'm not even sure, again, that this is workable. And what I would suggest to members is, you know, Representative Mueller and Representative Carlson and the rest of you, if you have issues with the bill, the things that you named off are completely workable and fixable. And I would ask that you, you know, withdraw this amendment and work with me and all the interested stakeholders to try to come up with a better solution than what these provisions are doing. Thanks.
Okay. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was actually going to kind of make that point. The one thing that Representative Mueller did point out, which, because I work in domestic violence statutes quite a bit, kind of perked my ear, and that was the difference between the clear and convincing that you have here and preponderance of evidence, which is what you need for an OFP, HRO, DANCO. So I'm just wondering if Representative Scott, if you could just speak to your thought, sort of this as this became, you know, an idea, where clear and convincing came from as opposed to preponderance of evidence. That would help me to understand that part.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I said in committee that the evening that we had the hearing last week or whenever it was, that is, I know that's a source of contention for some people. And what we're trying to get away from and trying to solve is the issue of false allegations that arise a lot of times in these family law situations. And right now in CHIPS court, the standard is clear and convincing. And one of the statements that I made was that it should not be easier to lose your child in family court than it is in CHIPS court. And so that was the reasoning for that. But I know that it's across other states that some have preponderance and some don't. So I don't think that's a major sticking point on this issue. Thank you.
Senator O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Representative Scott. I didn't know that about CHIPS court. So that's why you're the expert over there on that. And so I appreciate you bringing that forward. That makes so much more sense now that you pointed that out. And with that, I absolutely would support the language as is and not support the amendment, because I feel like you really have worked this language to the point where it's really fair. It's much more fair. And like you had said, that the agreement had been in place for 5 years, and we haven't really seen a lot of movement in the court, and hopefully this will push it a little bit further. So now I understand the clear and convincing, and that makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Okay. Anyone else want to speak? We've got the Bar Association guy. John Reinke wants to come down and say how much he dislikes it. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
And while he's taking a seat, members, so we're past our committee time. Here's the deal. We got through him to 12:30. Wouldn't it be cool if we could get this done and not have to come back tonight? I don't know, but I want us to stay. People can raise an objection if they want to, but I don't know. Mr. Reinke, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with that in mind, I'll try and keep my comments brief. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota State Bar Association Family Law Section in support of the A3 Amendment, including with today's amendment to the amendment. I'm a solo practitioner, and I have a primary focus in the area of family law. I practice in rural Minnesota. I represent both moms and dads, and I represent a lot of clients on a reduced fee basis because of their income and financial situation. The State Bar Association Family Law Section has not taken a formal position on this amendment, but the amendment is in line with our other positions, which seek to prevent further limitations on judicial discretion and establishment of greater presumptions for parenting time. to clarify a misunderstanding that I've heard a few times in this room, both today and the last time this bill came forward, and including in the media, the current law does not require that one parent get 75% and the other get 25. That 25 is meant to be a floor, and courts do, and often do, from my experience, go above that, including to equal time. So 25-75 is not the only alternative here. 25% is meant to be a minimum. The A3 amendment places both parents on equal footing, and it allows for a greater focus on what's best for the children, what's best for them, and we look back at those best interest factors, including the one that Representative Moeller discussed earlier regarding maximizing parenting time for both parents. I heard Ms. Olson talk about how that's best for children, and I would note that is part of the law already in 518.17. This amendment does resolve the state bar's previously addressed concerns. One of my colleagues was here last week testifying against House File 1666, and this amendment, the A3, addresses those concerns. One thing that I did not hear come up in conversation today is regarding the mental health concerns and the efficacy, whether or not a therapist can breach that privilege in recommending that a parent not have parenting time. We talked about the privacy of the parent, but I haven't heard anything about whether or not that would be a breach of a therapist's code of ethics. And in my opinion, from my discussions with various therapists, it would be.
Mr. Rinke, please wrap it up.
Thank you. Minnesota has seen a long history of changes to parenting time presumptions. We used to view mothers as incapable of providing for the children, and we always gave custody to dads. Then we switched that around, as Representative Liebling discussed, where we almost gave it exclusively to the mothers. Recently, we've taken a focus on the best interests of the children. The A3 amendment takes that focus one step further and ensures that we continue along that page instead of trying to force children and parents into a statutory one-size-fits-all parenting schedule. This amendment does support...
Mr. Rinke, please wrap it up.
This amendment does support the interests of the Bar Association, and we'd ask your support for the amendment.
Okay. Any questions? Brief, if there are any brief questions. Okay. Chair Gonstein, question?
No question.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Chair Scott.
Thank you. If I could just rebut a couple of the comments that were made. This bill is not a one-size-fits-all. There's still plenty of discretion for the judges in here. These are just some new considerations. And if the language surrounding mental health is an issue, let's find a better answer. But right now, I know that people go through evaluations of some sort because the judge has to have something to make his decision on. So there has to be some input regarding someone's mental capabilities. And so whatever, if that's the whatever they're using now, let's continue to use that, and maybe we just leave this section out. But we were trying to address some of the folks that were opposed to this legislation when they talked about mental illness. And we know it's a really difficult area to get proper wording for. But we wanted that to be a consideration because that can affect the safety of a child. So I think that, again, rather than throwing the baby out with the bathwater with this amendment that is so sweeping, let's work on House File 1666. And
Chair Scott, we're going to vote on this like in about 10 seconds.
All right, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry to cut you off, but people want to go. Okay, so 10 seconds. Representative O'Neill.
Really
quick. Representative Moeller.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to apologize to Chair Scott for not coming to you first. I wasn't sure it was going to end up in the omnibus bill, but I do apologize for not talking about this. And I would really like to work with you further on this, on language. And I just ask that we do include groups like MCBW and Legal Aid in those discussions as we move forward. And, Mr. Chair, I will ask for a roll call.
Seriously? Roll call's been requested. Chair votes no.
Representative Moeller?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Barr?
No.
Representative Cantrell?
Yes.
Representative Carlson?
Yes.
Representative Considine?
No.
Representative Grosso? Representative Hassan?
Yes.
Representative Herr?
Yes.
Representative Johnson? Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Lucero?
No.
Representative Mariani?
Yes.
Representative Moore?
Yes.
Representative O'Neill?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Zhang?
Yes.
On a vote of 9 ayes and 8 nays, the motion prevails. Moving on to the A4 amendment. So there are several members that cannot be here. Chair Johnson.
Well, I was going to bring up, and over, we're about 17 minutes past our time. A number of our members have kids that are visiting our offices today over the lunchtime.
Okay.
I know we would like to get through this, but that's not often we have kids be able to be down here.
Met Chair Johnson, I've heard back channel from several people who think that we should come back tonight. So we're scheduled to come back tonight at what time?
5 p.m. in the basement.
5 p.m. basement hearing room. Committee is in recess. Judiciary Committee is back in session.
Go ahead.
We're moving on to the A4 amendment. It looks like the author, is here.
I'm here.
So you want to offer the A4 amendment to amend DE3. Go ahead, Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the A4 and the A5 are related, so I just want to state that for starters. But the A4 amendment kind of gets at what I'm referring to as the right-sizing of private data notification standards.
Okay.
Minnesota Statute 13.055 requires government entities to provide written notification to anyone whose private data is reasonably believed to have been obtained, accessed, or viewed by someone with the intent to use it for non-governmental purposes. This amendment proposes to change this to require notice when unauthorized acquisition of private data creates a significant risk to financial, reputational, or cause other harm to the person. Keep in mind that government agencies will continue to be held at a higher standard than the private sector as a part of this amendment. Because we are, since we are trusted with private data, we should be holding ourselves to a higher standard. By defining private data so broadly, Chapter 13 requires breach notification that is far more expansive than required for private business. Additionally, private businesses can evaluate risk to the individual in determining whether to issue a breach notice. This proposal does not change the scope of private data under Chapter 13, but does allow government agencies to evaluate risk when deciding whether to issue a breach notice. In addition, agencies can continue to comply with applicable federal laws such as HIPAA in responding to these breaches. So this is kind of in response to Section 1, and I think, again, I'll use the term right-sizing, what is really, I think, a more reasonable approach to addressing the data breach notification section. So with that, Mr. Chair, that is my amendment. I will also offer that I have here Christy Lochte-Johnson from Hennepin County, who's the Hennepin County Compliance Officer.
Come on down.
Answer any technical questions. She may have others as well if they so wish to join her.
Okay, and Kristen Anderson, who's going to testify on it before. I cut you off because I said we're going to have an amendment. Here's the big show. Welcome. Come on down. Do you want to speak to this, Ms. Anderson?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Kristen Anderson, General Counsel for Minnesota Management and Budget. We really do understand and appreciate the concerns that motivated Section 1 of House File 631, and we really are committed to trying to address those concerns. However, we do think that the bill will have some unintended consequences. We have met with the original House File 54 author, Representative Scott, regarding our concerns, and we really appreciate her time and willingness to listen to our concerns. The state's particular concerns really arise out of the unique structure of state government under the Data Practices Act and our interest in the effective and efficient operation of state government, and is addressed and really our concerns are addressed in the A4 amendment, specifically lines 1.11 to 1.13, and we would appreciate your support for these provisions. So to the specific issues affecting state government, most laws governing data breaches have provisions that exclude from the definition of breach situations of good faith unintentional access that does not involve third parties. And in fact, our own data breach statute has such a good faith exception that recognizes from time to time, as part of the day-to-day operations, good faith mistakes happen within an organization and should not be treated as data breaches. However, the provision in current law only applies to good faith access that occurs within a government entity. The state, however, under the Data Practices Act, is not considered a single government entity, but instead several and separate government entities. Despite this, we often operate as an enterprise. And Mr. Chair, I know that we had a little conversation about what enterprise means in our context.
I don't know what it is. But
sure. It means that we really operate in large part together with enterprise-wide common systems, common applications, interagency responsibilities. In many respects, we act as a single unit, although we technically are separate units under the law and separate responsible authorities and government entities under the Data Practices Act.
Ms. Anderson, I was driving into work this morning, and there was a thing on NPR where the Oculus fans were complaining about the Oculus being sold to Facebook, and Facebook's now going to market it for enterprise options for the Oculus. So your definition didn't help me understand what the heck they were talking about that on that. I'm not going to ask you to do that, but anyway, go on.
Maybe we use the word enterprise in different ways, Mr. Chair. But back to that, the way that we as state government act as an enterprise, we do have intergovernmental responsibilities and intergovernmental communication. So an example of this is that we all in the executive branch share a common email system.
I'm sorry, Ms. Anderson, can you hold up? Chair Johnson?
Chair Lesh, we're going through our, taking our stuff out of our files. We do not have the original amendment and the omnibus bill in our packets. We have no clue where this stuff is going.
The pages on the pages.
Okay, Chair Johnson, my apologies. They're on their way. Do you want to recess to get the copies, or do you want to hear the Q&A and have the bill in front of you when they're doing the Q&A?
Chair Lesh, a little hard to actually follow, look at the amendments.
You're right. No, that's accurate. Committee's in recess. Call of the chair.
Did they get the copies?
Neither do we. I just brought my stuff with us, so I was able to refer to my notes.
Is someone going to?
Yeah, just grabbing them. Yeah, they're going to grab them.
So it's all okay.
Yeah, it's not. It's not just. It's everybody. I just brought my stuff with me.
So
I know, and that's part of the confusion.
I'm sorry, but it just got that's what it's scheduled for. What's on my calendar? It says
for tomorrow?
That's what it says.
For this one?
For 9:30. It says 9:30 to 5.
Tomorrow?
Yeah. That's
probably your with the room.
She said that
room 1:20. Yeah. She was.
That's a Rachel. So my other checked in with Rachel. Like, is it really going to take 5? And I mean, they said she checked in with Rachel, and Rachel said 5:45.
Oh, you looked at. Good.
You think so? You are very optimistic.
I don't mind the exercise.
I'm going to yell at you for not out and out because I got to pick up the kid over. Because I'm being real hopeful too. Rachel, I have rules at 9:30, but they usually go pretty fast, so I'm going to be late for our meeting.
This is your A3. That's
no, it's not my A3. Had all these names written on it.
No, I think we're happy with it. It's an attachment on the committee. Do you want?
I just went up and got the copy. Duplicating is.
I'm assuming it's somewhere closer.
If you can send it to duplicating, okay. They're upstairs. But we don't have this upstairs.
Okay, I'm going to ask him for help.
To
duplicate.
No, I agree with you. I'm not voting at all. So.
Use your Wi-Fi.
I'm reading it.
She's in copy. She was already waiting.
What happened? Did they just accidentally
Well, yeah, because everyone throws their papers around. You just grab the ones that we thought were left.
But you have unlimited in your package, though.
Yeah.
Then that's awesome. Then you can move. Some people don't really think it's unlimited status, so then they run their hotspot and then it and charges them a ton of money. Yes. I have unlimited too. That's awesome.
Nothing really should be thrown away until, you know, unless we have a ton of amounts, nothing should be thrown away.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, she has to be back at Apple, yeah, so her computer can just be. Well, she might have a hotspot on her Samsung. You know, she can use your hotspot too. She can use your
No,
Growing up, that was kind of like
Well, I was talking about the eight. I think that was one of the problems. I think he was talking about both. Right. He did more explanation of the five.
Okay. Hey, Chair Johnson, can you make sure you check that you got what you need? I'll grab what's back in.
You got it? Judiciary Committee is back in session. Ms. Anderson, you're in the middle of a pertinent thought.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to back up a little bit just to make sure that we're on the same page. And I have to say, I feel like the universe is conspiring against me actually speaking at this hearing. But we'll work with it. We'll work with it. So
it's just bad karma.
So House File Section 1 of House File 631 eliminates the intent requirement from the data breach notification statute. And that provision, standing by itself, causes some very odd complications and, I think, unintended consequences for state government because of the weird situation that we're in the Data Practices Act. And we believe that the A4 amendment, introduced by Representative Carlson, fixes our concern, and so we're asking for your support of that amendment. And I just want to kind of walk you through to understand exactly why it is that it's problematic to simply get rid of the intent requirement and not replace it with some of the language that's in the A4 amendment. So again, as I said, state government is not one government entity under the Data Practices Act. We are not permitted to freely share information in between agencies, and yet we have lots and lots of interagency responsibilities and interagency systems, and so the possibility of having an inadvertent yet good faith disclosure is there. But currently, the law and its definition of a good faith access that wouldn't be constituting a data breach really looks at the purposes of the government entity. So if there is a good faith access for the purpose of the government entity, there's no data breach. But of course, as I said, state government is not considered a single government entity. So currently, under current law, we wouldn't use that provision to find that we don't have a data breach. Instead, we'd look at the intent to use the data for non-governmental purpose, determined that there wasn't an intent to use the data for non-governmental purposes, and accordingly determined that there was no data breach. Let me give you an example.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a question to testify on that regarding how you're explaining this. So I used to work for a large medical device manufacturer here in the state of Minnesota in their IT security department, and as such, they are subjected to HIPAA and high-tech regulations. And within that employer, there's a mandate to protect information. And so my question for you is, as you're describing this, good faith efforts, would you, if we were to take out the word government entity in this case and insert any private sector organization, would you be comfortable with the standard that you're articulating here, that a good faith effort, even if there was a data breach, but there was a good faith effort to protect consumer PHI in this example, would be sufficient? And then even if it was another employee within that employer, that if they viewed information unauthorized and they were did not have access to, if they viewed it, as you're articulating here, if it's another government employee, would you be comfortable with that, applying that same standard to a private sector?
Ms. Anderson.
So, Mr. Chair, members, representative, let me maybe explain what I'm talking about here is assumes that the data does not exit government. So it's all data that's within the governmental structure. So it's not data that goes outside to third parties. We absolutely agree that if the data goes outside government to third parties, there's a data breach, and we need to give a data breach notification, and we do that.
Well, what, Mr. Chair, can go ahead, Representative.
I have another example then. So one of the things that we've heard in recent headlines it's been going on for over a decade. Mm-hmm. When a high-profile movie star, actor, or something like that goes into a hospital, and their medical records are viewed and looked up by perhaps nurses or other staff personnel in the hospital that are not part of that patient, not treating at all, that's an unauthorized access of that information. It hasn't left the hospital. Nothing's happened to it, but it's been viewed unauthorized by an unauthorized person.
Well, Representative Lucero, I don't think that point is lost on members of the committee, considering that I think that the highest number of payouts in the millions that Minnesota governments have had to pay in the last 10 years have been to cops looking up information that they weren't allowed to view, and that was all within government. So how would you respond to that, Ms. Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. In those situations, that is not actually good faith access for the purpose of government. That is a frolicking detour that's outside of the purposes of government, and that also would be a data breach and wouldn't be protected.
I feel I'm at the Court of Appeals. Well, you just said frolicking detour. Anyway, right, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
It's like a Supreme Court argument. Go ahead, Ms. Anderson.
Essentially, the law already has this good faith exception. And all we are trying to do is make sure that the state government gets the benefit of that good faith exception on an equal footing as a county employee disclosing good faith inadvertent information to another county employee. Again, because we're different government entities, although we're one state, we can't take advantage of that. And this is really lines 1.11. To 1.13 of the A4 amendment are really addressing our concerns to ensure that state government is treated the same way that any other government entity is treated when there are, again, those good faith inadvertent accesses for the purposes of government.
Excellent. Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Other questions from Ms. Anderson? Chair Johnson, you had a question? Oh, you didn't. Okay. Any other comments to the A4 amendment? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to the author of the amendment. On line 1.11, it states governmental purposes. What other purposes would there be for accessing government data? What other purposes would an employee look at unauthorized information during the course of their job? Wouldn't it all be governmental purposes? So everything they do has a governmental purpose?
Mr. Carlson, or Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. You know, I have the same question, and I'm going to defer to my testifiers to see if they have an example.
Is that
speak to that?
Sure. So, Mr. Chair, Representative, I can give an example of what would be, in this circumstance, a good faith access. So I'm trying to send an email to John Anderson from MMB, but I skip the middle initial and wind up sending an email to John Anderson at PCA. Again, we're separate government entities, and so that doesn't fall into the current good faith exception. But as long as John Anderson from PCA doesn't then in turn go and use that data for non-governmental purposes, it's a governmental purpose for him to actually open his email. We want him to open his email. And so as long as he doesn't further disseminate that information, it would fall in the good faith exception and not be a data breach. On the other hand, if John Anderson decided to use that data, there is no governmental purpose there, and that would be a data breach. That distinction makes
Ms.
sense.
Anderson, how about instead of mistyping the email to that other John Anderson, he mistypes the email and it gets posted to Twitter, because you can still do that. You can still email at Twitter. How about that? Is that good faith exception too?
Mr. Chair, members, I think that does not fall into the good faith exception, because at that point it's gone outside of government, and the individuals on Twitter can't possibly have a governmental purpose because they're not part of government.
Sure, Scott.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So as Representative Lesh brought up, the issue of folks in law enforcement internally looking with no authorization at people's data, even if it was authorized, let's say in your example, John P. Anderson is mistaken for John A. Anderson. John A. Anderson gets something that's intended for John P. Anderson. And what John P. Anderson does is he goes like this. And he captures on his phone the information that he was sent. And then he sends it back and says, oh, sorry, I'm getting rid of this for you. Under what you've done here, your language here would allow for that to happen. And it would not be considered a data breach.
Okay, other questions from Ms. Anderson? Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, not to the testifier, but to the bill author. Mm-hmm. When I'm looking at lines 1.7 through 1.9, current law defines a breach of the security of the data means unauthorized acquisition of data maintained by a government entity that comprises the security and classification of the data. When I look at the new language, there's references that changes that definition to data that's defined per 325E.61 and 144.291. Mm-hmm. I've looked both of those up. I have them both here. And I am inquiring of the bill author why he chose to do that.
Representative Carlson. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Rosero. I, too, looked those up and don't have them in front of me right now. If you're willing, you just have them on your laptop.
Oh, okay.
I can read them if that helps, Mr. Chair.
I don't know if
How
that's...
How long is it?
Not very long.
I don't know what that means. Like, is it like a... How many lines is it?
So, Mr. Chair, 325E61 includes Social Security number, driver's license number, or identification number, and then an account or credit card number in combination with a security code, et cetera, et cetera. That's 325. 144 is a patient's name, address, date of birth, gender, parents or guardian's name, regardless of age of the patient, and other non-clinical data.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, to your question, can you repeat the question, please?
Representative Lucero.
Why did you choose to change the definition?
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, based on my conversations with the agencies as well as with the county, this seemed like a defined list to which would provide some clarity in terms of how to interpret the definition. So with that was part of what I recall from our conversation, but I also defer to Ms. Anderson to expand upon that.
Oh, boy. Well,
Mr. Chair, I can...
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to save time. So we don't need to expand upon that, but what I would point out to the bill author and to this committee is that this change in definition narrows the definition of what data is that should be protected, and I am highly against this change. And what I mean by that is, for example, IP addresses, vehicle identifiers, email addresses, biometric identifiers would all be excluded from this. And then I would also point out the cross-reference to 325E61 says that the Social Security number, driver's license number, and account number are only part of that definition if they were encrypted. If they weren't encrypted by the government system, the technology system, they were in the clear text, that would not be considered. And again, this is not the definition we use in the private sector for private information. So I'm posted, and I've got more, Mr. Chair.
Ooh, I bet you do.
Can you respond?
Well, I mean, that's kind of interesting. Yes, Representative Carlson, but you know, I wonder what Ms. Anderson has to say about that, what you left out, and why.
Mr. Chair, members, my principal testimony is really in support of 1.11 to 1.13, but I can address the changes of 1.7 to 1.9. That is language that we came up with together with Department of Administration. The idea is, as I think Representative Carlson talked about, the idea of right-sizing the data breach notice requirements. The positive portion, and obviously there are other provisions that could be added to this, but I think that government entities, we really do want to comply with this law, but this law is very, very complicated and hard to interpret. That's why I have a job. I have full-time employment because of very complicated laws by the data, like the Data Practices Act. So providing some sort of clarity, thank you very much. So providing some sort of clarity to government entities so that we know right off the bat, if we've got this kind of data that has gone outside of government, we know right away that this is a data breach and we need to provide the notification. So having some kind of clarity was really the purpose of trying to propose this kind of
language. Representative Carlson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and Representative Acero used the word narrow. I would just use the word clarify, providing clarity to the agencies so that when these incidents occur, it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, that they have clear direction in terms of how to make those interpretations.
Well, hey, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson, the data sets that Representative Lucero says are excluded, why did you want to exclude them? You say this just provides clarity, but you did exclude certain data sets, and I assume you had a reason for those.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would defer back to then what the definition goes on to further say with the good faith exception, and that being the guiding principle behind the decision-making process. That's my grasp of where this is coming from, and again, I would defer to my testifiers to expand upon that.
Well, Representative Lucero.
Mr. Chair, then I would ask the bill author, and this is your amendment, would you be comfortable with a good faith effort in the private sector with your personal private information falling outside the scope that you're attempting to do? And that's rhetorical. You can answer it if you want. But the point is, you are narrowing. The present law is data, which is more broad and would include some of the elements of personal data that I've mentioned. You're making it more narrow, and so you're allowing unauthorized access to information. And then there's this other criteria, double standard. We don't have that standard in... We don't have a good faith effort in the private sector. And what's good for private sector that has been mandated by government should also be good for government. And again, members, I would highly oppose this A4 amendment. It is not good. Moves us in the wrong direction.
Members, this reminds me of the ongoing list of unwritten committee rules. The first one this session is you're allowed to ask rhetorical questions, but people are not compelled to answer them. So that's unwritten rule number one. Representative Liebling.
So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm somewhat of an outsider to this conversation, but I'm just trying to listen here and figure out what's going on. And what I'm kind of understanding here is I think that there are really two important different pieces of this amendment, and I do think that Representative Lucero is correct that this is narrowing the field of concern here, and I mean, as I'm understanding, this all is going to what triggers notification, right? So the real issue that we want to get at is that when there's some kind of a breach that is presents a risk to individuals, then government ought to be notifying them. So I do agree that perhaps this isn't drafted correctly, because I'm getting the sense that what Representative Carlson is trying to do here is be more specific with the term data and help guide agencies by being more specific, but perhaps the amendment really needs a bit more work because it excludes things perhaps beyond where he, I don't want to put words in his mouth, but you know, it seems as though there are things excluded here that really should not be excluded. On the other hand, the second piece of the amendment, I am kind of, as I'm looking at this, it does make sense to me, this piece on line 1.11 to 1.13, that it's not a matter of giving government more privileges than private industry. The question is really, what is the risk to the individual? And I think that what the attempt to do is here is to say, let's strike a balance. I remember the chair at one point saying, it's this committee's purview to decide how much risk should be taken. And I think that that is what this amendment is trying to set up by saying that if this is to for governmental purposes and it doesn't go outside of government, then or being accessed for non-governmental purposes, that there's kind of a risk-benefit thing going on here, that the that this amendment is trying to say that that's not such a risk that we should then go off and notify people about it. And, you know, even though as individuals you might think, well, I want to be notified every time there's any kind of breach, you know, there is a downside to notifying people, too, when there isn't really a risk to them, and that is that it gets people upset. They may not understand what to do. You know, so I think there is something here where we do need to tighten this up a bit, and I'm not sure that the this amendment as written is exactly doing the right thing, but I guess what I'm saying is that I'm kind of with you, Representative Lucero, on that first piece, and I think more work needs to be done to get this right. However, I do think the second piece of it makes sense to strike the right balance, that we shouldn't just be, you know, forcing government agencies to notify everybody when there really isn't a risk to their data being used for bad purposes.
Mr. Chair, just
thank
a quick follow-up.
You, Chair Liebling. You'll get a chance at the end, Representative Lucero. Bills like this, Representative Carlson, you know, and that, when it's complicated, and I think for the reasons brought up by Chair Liebling and other folks, it's not something you can offer on the fly, an anonymous bill. You got to work with stakeholders back and forth and come up with clean language that makes sense. So I'm going to oppose this today, and maybe you can, you know, follow the route that, that others have to get this in. And maybe get some cleanup language. So I'm going to pose this now. But Representative Lucero, final word.
I'll make it real quick.
Since this is your provision, Chair Scott, and then we'll vote on it. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. Oh, and just to follow up to Chair Liebling.
You're not on the list, but you want to go to Chair Johnson? Okay, go ahead.
So Lucero, just real quick. Johnson. So when risk is in the is subjective, and the elements that go into quantifying risk, there's qualitative and quantitative risk. And what you're referring to is, what for the, based on what I heard, was quantitative, and that's subjective, and that's, it's for that reason that one of the foundations of cybersecurity, one of the basic principles, first 101, the principle of least privilege is what we teach in the profession, and we narrow access to those that are only required to have privilege to do their job. And when that principle has been violated, it doesn't matter. We don't. It's not part of the standard good faith. It's not part of the standard to quantify risk, because the person who is responsible for the breach, they have a vested interest in making sure that the risk, as subjectively defined, would be in their favor versus the recipient. So that's why that was removed. And back, you know, when we were debating this early in the early 2000s on the standards and requirements for protection, some of these same arguments were brought up. But in, for good reasons, they were weighed to be not as good as the requirements to protect information because they have a fiduciary responsibility. And in many of these cases, government might be collecting this information unaware or involuntarily of the citizens. And I would argue that there's even a greater responsibility by government to protect this. That's why I would not be in favor of those exceptions. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Chair Johnson.
Members, I have, even when this bill came out, I had concerns on this provision. And it was brought up very, very, very bright. The reason we have the intent, and both Representative Scott and Chair Lesh brought up the incident involving law enforcement. The way I read this, because the intent isn't there anymore with this bill, every time an officer reads a license plate incorrectly and it's dispatched, whether it's put in over the air or to his MDD screen, would now have to do a notification. It was inadvertent. He typed the wrong letter, hit enter, the wrong information came up. Was there intent? Absolutely not. Did he see the information? Absolutely. We got to figure this out because the way this bill is written, a letter would have to be sent to that person to let them know that your information had been inadvertently given out. And the number of license plates that are inaccurately read, trying to read them, especially with this weather that we have right now, there's got to be 5,000 to 7,000 a day. House File 5 actually clears that issue up. Is there some problems with House File or the A5? Yes.
We're on A4.
For A4. But it's a lot less problems than what's in the current bill.
Just Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I would just want to remind members that this idea was brought to me by the Office of the Legislative Auditor as being something that was problematic in statute. And this amendment, again, governmental purposes, that is pretty much everything these agencies do. So I think this is really problematic. It's kind of opening a door wide enough to drive a truck through. And so, folks, I would encourage a no vote on the amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so Chair Liebling wanted to weigh in very briefly. Is that right?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to oppose the amendment as well, simply because I think that first part is way too broad. But I just want to respond to Representative Lucero briefly and just say, I think that this is not setting out government's responsibility to protect the data. That's a different thing. And I would agree with you that government has a strong responsibility to protect the data. This is just trying to set a line so that agencies know when they're supposed to notify. That's, I think, a different issue.
Thank you. Representative Carlson, 60 seconds.
Okay. So just to clarify a few things, Representative Johnson, to be clear, the original language removes the intent requirement from the data breach notification statute. So that's what's in there now. This is trying to restore that. So I think you should take another look at that, because it sounds like you're arguing my point. To the fact that this was brought forward by the legislative auditor, this was my understanding. This was brought back from an agency employee, so not by the agency itself, but by a state employee. So let's be clear on that note as well. Mr. Chair and members, this bill was not something we concocted in the middle of the night. This has been thoroughly vetted by those that are directly impacted by it, as well as by those that are charged with implementing it. And they take their jobs very seriously. So while we know we wade into these issues on a regular basis, I feel the clarifying language that's brought forth here provides, our job as legislator is to provide direction to the agencies, and that's exactly what this bill does. Okay. It provides them with a means in which to do their jobs.
Thank you. Okay. All in favor of the A4 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion does not prevail. A5 amendment, Representative Wilson.
Okay.
Moving on, the A5, similar but different. Okay. This is the data breach risk analysis. So while before we were talking about the private sector standard requirement, this is the data breach risk analysis. The bill, I'll be brief in my opening remarks and then turn it over to my testifier. You can see here that provides some clarifying language and then gets into these five standards to which to guide that decision-making process. You can all read, so spend a moment to kind of look through those, and at that, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Okay, you're the testifier. Please be brief.
I will. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this evening. My name is Christy Lottie Johnson, and I am the responsible authority and data practices compliance official for Hennepin County. We previously met with Representative Scott and others from this committee to share our concerns about House File 54 as it's currently written. And I'd like to tag on to what Representative Johnson said earlier. I think the removal of the intent is one of those issues that when we start looking at the law enforcement individuals who looked up the data for looking up license plates and everything like that, they do have the authority to look up license plates. However, they were looking them up with the intent to use that data for non-governmental purposes. And so part of my concern with the removal of the intent is that it does take away some of that concept of we want government people to be using the data for governmental purposes, and if you remove that intent language, then you remove the language about the intent for using the data for non-governmental purposes. Regarding the proposed language for the risk assessment, we looked a lot at what other organizations like HIPAA, or organizations, I guess, regulatory bodies like HIPAA do in looking at what is the level of risk, how is the data accessed, and other things to determine whether or not we would need to do a data breach notification. It's also similar to what the private sector has to do when they do a data breach notification, in that they do look at what is the risk of harm to the individual. The reason that 365E.61 outlines Social Security number, driver's license number, and bank account information is because there's a significant financial risk to individuals if that data is accessed. There's less financial risk for some of the things that are in the Data Practices Act. And in part, it's because the way the Data Practices Act is written is that private data can be different things in different parts of the Data Practices Act. So, for example, the fact that I'm receiving employment work services, that and just my name.
Ms. Johnson, please wrap it up?
Yep, I will.
Thank you.
So part of it is that the private data is just looked at differently, and we would like to have a consistent type of notification when risk is really raised to the level that it would be a risk to the individual.
Ms. Johnson, and then Representative Lucero is going to ask a question, but creepy DNR guy who was looking up everyone's info, I'm looking at this list of criteria you got. You got the nature of the unauthorized acquisition, the type, nature and type of data breach, which is license information, the likelihood that the breach caused the data to become accessible, he was the only one looking at it, the likelihood the breach would result in harm to the subject, he wasn't doing anything with it, he was just ogling it in a creepy way, and the ability of the government entity to mitigate the risk of harm to the subject of the data. Well, they fired him, so they mitigated harm, they got out of there. It looks like, based upon your own criteria, there would be no problem with creepy DNR guy looking at everyone's license.
Chair Lesh, I think the way we would review that is that we would look at the fact that he was looking up driver's license information and home address information, and that would be a risk that we would notify on.
Well, I wouldn't see that based upon the criteria you laid out, but Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I won't ask any questions. I'll just make some points. So going back to, which one is this, 325E. So just to be clear, the Social Security number that you referenced, the driver's license number, and the account number are only considered personal information if they are, quote, not secured by encryption or another method of technology that makes electronic data unreadable or unusable. So House members here, and everyone will be familiar, that our pay stubs are emailed to us at our House emails with, and they're encrypted with the last four digits of our Social Security numbers.
Are you going to really say that? Now everyone can get it.
That's going to be my point.
Next thing you know, there's going to be naked pictures you float out on the internet.
So, Mr. Chair.
Sorry, go ahead.
And if those members who were around two terms ago in our like Representative Considine, I sent a reply all, and I let the entire House know that an encryption code of four characters, and it's only 10 possibilities for each of the four, that can be cracked with any PDF cracker in less than 1 second, and I did that. So if I have any of your emails, I can crack your pay stub in less than a second with freeware. So the definition in statute, that would qualify. And that's, again, to my point, why this is not good. So to this, we looking at line 1.11, sorry, at 1.10, if the unauthorized acquisition creates a significant risk. So what's the difference between risk and significant risk? So if it creates just a risk, well, that's okay. But it has to be a significant risk. How is that determined? Where's that line? The next question is evaluating. Who's doing the evaluating? So this, to me, the way that as it was explained by the testifier, this will be the department themselves. That's a conflict of interest. That's the fox guarding the hen house. We don't have a third party that's quantifying the risk. And how do we define harm? How is harm defined? Again, it's the eye of the beholder. And so when there's a data breach, many times you have a third party who can provide an evaluation and determine if the risk and the harm might be justified. And so I would not be comfortable with this language either. I would highly oppose this because there is just a lot of legroom in here that allows for the eroding of confidence that Minnesotans are due and expect from our government agencies. Thank you.
Chair Johnson. Oh, you're not talking. Okay. Anyone else? Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just ask members to oppose this as well. This is setting up some sort of a review process, and I think sometimes, you know, it's really important just to get the information that the data was breached out the door instead of having a bunch of government lawyers sit around and decide, well, is this a significant risk, and what about on lines 1.11, other harm to the subject of the data? What does that entail? So I think this is too vague, and As Representative Lucero said, I don't think this is something that we need to put in the hands of the agency in and of themselves. I think that this is something that we as lawmakers have to decide upon what the standard is going to be, set it in law, and then it applies to everyone. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Last word, Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, wait a second. Chair Liebling, you want to speak on this? Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, I'm really listening to what everybody is saying about this, and I do recognize that this might not be the right standard, but the thing is, with the change in the bill, I think we need a standard. I think this is what you're saying, Chair Scott. And I just, because otherwise, well, you weren't saying this, but otherwise I think that what happens is that they have to notify pretty much about everything. And notifying about everything, that might be okay, but I think that we're really, it might not be okay. So, I don't know that this is the right thing either. I hear you. I think there are a lot of problems with the way this is written. I don't like the term significant risk in there either. And this was discussed when the bill was heard. We really do need to have some guidelines, and I don't know how we can write those because it's either a bright line, which people don't like because it isn't the right bright line, and everybody thinks of all these situations that won't work with that bright line, or it's a thing that entails somebody's discretion, which is never good enough because it involves discretion. So I don't know which it is. We're kind of between a rock and a hard place here. I guess I'm going to, support the chair on the amendment, but I just think we need something, and I wish we could figure out a way to get that something into law. I appreciate that Representative Carlson is at least trying to figure this out.
Representative Herb.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. And this isn't my area of expertise either, so I am really listening to what everybody else is saying, and I guess I just want to make sure, And I get Representative Lucero's point, but I guess I was just curious because even in the laws that govern private institutions, you know, they talk about how, like, you know, if the information is already publicly available, they don't have to notify for those reasons. And, like, you could have sent, you know, you cracked it, but, I mean, our data is public already, right? I mean, where we live, how much we get paid. And so I guess, I don't know if maybe that's why our institution does what it does. And I'm not saying that, I'm not justifying saying that's okay. Maybe that's why they do, because they know that there's nothing that those particular things, it's already public information, and whether somebody can crack it or not, it's already public. They could get it anyways. But, you know, I am really concerned about the, coming from the private sector, having been there 15 years, and then coming to the to public sector, I hear a lot about people complaining about waste in government and how much money we spend and how inefficient we are. And I can't help but feel like, and I don't know enough about this, and maybe I can just chat with different people offline, but that this creates these onerous processes that end up costing a lot of money and time. And even within the statutes that govern private institutions, they have something that says that if the cost of providing notice is over a certain dollar amount, and it gives them all these provisions about what it is that they can do and how they may go around so that they, you know, if it's too expensive to do, right? And do we have something like that within government? Because if I have to send a note, like I work at the city, if we have to send a notification, we would have to have full-time people. All they're doing is sending out notification, the cost of printing and the cost of postage. And like, to me, I feel like if we're really going to do people right by some of these things that we're doing, we should really think about all of those things as well, right? And I don't know if this does it. I don't know if there's something else that could potentially do that. But it's just things that I'm thinking about, and I want us to maybe all consider. And I appreciate Representative Carlson's effort in doing this, because I have heard from people who work for government entities saying, literally, this is all I do, and it's not really good use of taxpayers' dollars because it actually doesn't do anything, and nobody used it for anything. And it's, you know, and so I don't know. Those are just thoughts. I'm just putting out there for us to think about too. And I appreciate that.
Last word. Chair Scott, and then last word, Representative Carlson. Go ahead, Chair Scott.
I'll pass in the interest of time.
Last word. Okay. Representative Carlson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, again, some clarifying comments. Review process on data breaches are already taking place. This is trying to provide some framework so that they're all conducting a set of standards to reviewing those data breaches. That's what this does. Provides some conformity around that so that it's conducted in a uniform way. Also, members, I'll refer you back to what is, you know, bring us back home here a little bit. This is, to a certain extent, in response to what's before us under Section 1. This, what we have right now in front of us, deletes under Section 1, subsection C, it's eliminating the intent piece. This is in response to that. So keep in mind, we're not going back to status quo, folks. We have what's in front of us here is a change to this section, 13.055. So keep that in mind. We're not status quo. This is an attempt to what me and others have perceived as a way in getting at the concern that was originally brought up. So with that in mind, we are trying to provide some safeguards. We are providing some uniformity in terms of review process. I think that's something that is important. So keep that in mind with your vote on this, is that we're not back to where we started. We do have an issue here that is hasn't received much discussion, but I think definitely deserves some.
All in favor of the A5 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. No. Motion does not prevail. The A7 amendment, is that being offered? It's not being offered. So to the bill as amended, committee discussion. Any committee discussion? Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, members. We got a lot of problems with the removal of intent. Because now we have, I'm not sure how many employees we're going to have to hire just to, if this goes through and ends up, how many, just to do notifications, not just at the state level, every county, every city, every township. I don't know how many of you had people in your office and you have your laptop up. Mine's set up so the people that come in can't see it. But if you set it the other way, like some offices, state offices are, you can see the screen. Guess what? Everybody that walks by that, every time somebody walks by that, you have to notify everybody whose ever information you're looking at on that screen. because they viewed it. You don't know if they saw it or not, but they walked by and it was available so they could see it. If you have another employee walk into your office and you have your screen up, somebody's viewed it. Notification. But there's a lot of problems with that section of it, and we got to get that fixed. I don't know how, but I want to thank Representative Carlson for at least trying to fix it. It's a lot of problems with that, and it's going to cost the state, the counties, the cities, the townships, the schools, colleges, any government agency, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to add one more thing, and that was that when Mr. Busey met with me, and I believe that he even said this in his testimony, was that when he was at Minute, he said that people are already operating under the assumption that when there was a breach, people were notified. And he was shocked to learn that the law even had this intent piece in it. And so I think most agencies are already doing this. They're already notifying in case in the case of breaches. And so I don't know that agencies and local units of government are really going to operate that much differently because they are already operating under that other assumption. Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, members, here's what we're left with here. Under Section C, unauthorized acquisition means that a person has obtained, accessed, or viewed government data without the informed consent of the individuals who are the subjects of the data or statutory authority, period. What we deleted were the words, and with the intent to use the data for non-governmental purposes. We eliminated the intent piece. So now agencies are required, helter-skelter, any type of request are going to be notified. Getting back to some of the concerns that were raised earlier. Doesn't matter what it is, you're going to be notified. Do you have any direction on what to do with it? No. Figure it out for yourself. This is what amendments, and maybe I wasn't articulate enough in describing what it is we were trying to do, but again, this simple change creates a lot of chaos in government, which is not a good thing.
Any other comments to the entire omnibus bill as amended, Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, and what my final comment was going to be on the last amendment is the case of the encryption that I'm referring to is that as written, it would be if it was encrypted. But encrypted isn't defined. It's subjective. And my example of the PDFs can be decrypted like that. But that would qualify as encryption. So it's a false sense of security. To Representative Lieben's point, and I get it, this is, I think we're actually in agreement. And one of the things that with me, this is an exciting topic, most people just put them to bed, but I get excited and talk about this, and I can come across as more animated, but it's just it's something that's important. And one of the things that we've done in the private sector is, it is true that with notifications there's an increase in costs, but that becomes a driver to otherwise cybersecurity continues to fall down and doesn't get a lot of priority. And so what happened is with these regulations over the last decade and a half, we've made the cost of notification more expensive than it would be to hire the staff and put the resources necessary into either not collecting the information to begin with, or if you do collect it, ensure that it is protected accurately, correctly. And when that's the case, there wouldn't be these helter-skelter data breaches like was just referenced. But no, what would happen is it would force agencies to take more seriously, develop more and stronger policies, and ensure that they are being followed. That's how you avoid the data breaches. So then you don't have to send out notifications. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I support the bill.
Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only comment on this whole data security thing is if we make it as restrictive as possible, or as we have to make as many notifications as possible, and it becomes that cumbersome, maybe the government will stop collecting as much data as they collect.
Representative Liebling.
I just couldn't resist commenting, Mr. Chair, that Representative Lucero just gave a really good speech in favor of regulation. And besides that, I just want to say that I...
Big government commie.
You know, other than... yeah. Other than having a little bit of concern about this Article 1 piece, I think the rest is a pretty good bill. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments to the omnibus bill? Needless to say...
I'm just kidding.
Okay. We are not going to take any public testimony on the omnibus bill as amended because we have had hearings on each one of these bills, unless someone's going to have an absolute coronary because they didn't get to speak to this. Is anyone out there going to have a coronary? Okay, it doesn't sound like it. Thank you very much. Then to the bill as amended by the DE3 amendment and amended by the various amendments to the DE3 amendment and then the various oral amendments to those amendments. It's supposed to be funny, but it's House File, what, 631 is amended, be recommended to be placed on the general register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Members, thank you for your hard work on this. We are in tomorrow morning at 9:30, and we will be in 120 in the Capitol. So, committee is adjourned.
Oh,
wait.
What just one other comment.
I haven't tapped the gavel yet, so what?
So just one other comment, and for those of you that are freshmen, you don't know this, but, and I don't know if Representative Lesh is Irish or not, but in the last 3-4 years, he's bought this committee Shamrock Shakes.
That's
around
true.
Around St. Patrick's Day.
And Madam Chair.
That's true.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. I actually friendly reminder to Chair Lesh here a couple days ago, and I likewise am equally disappointed in not having the Shamrock Shakes.
Well, tomorrow's a new day.
Well, I appreciate Republicans always wanting other people to pay for their benefits. But we will see what we can do. Committee is adjourned.